listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Democrats in Wisconsin are hopeful after their party won in a deeply red state like Alabama. An expert tells us whether Wisconsin could ride a pro-democratic wave hitting parts of the country. Now, a long night's sleep can seem like a luxury, but it turns out that the time we spend asleep is as important to our bodies as eating well and exercising. And it's not your imagination if you think how, when, and how long you sleep has changed over the years. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. He's a former professor of psychiatry at Harvard University, and his most recent book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's set the stage. What actually happens when we sleep?
Well, we used to think that sleep was largely a passive state where the body simply rested and the mind was dormant. And now we know nothing further from the truth could be happening here. The brain is incredibly and intensely active. In fact, during some stages of sleep, your brain is up to 30% more active than when you're awake. And that's critical for aspects of learning, memory, creativity. It also helps with emotional therapy. It provides a form of essentially emotional first aid. Downstairs in the body, we know that deep sleep actually offers one of the greatest forms of blood pressure medication that you could ever wish for. It also seems to recharge your immune system and refresh that immune system. It also overhauls aspects of our metabolism, things like our ability to regulate glucose to keep us away from a path of diabetes. And sleep also regulates our appetite hormones so that we don't overeat the next day, so that we feel satisfied with our food and that we're making the right choices in terms of what we eat.
I thought it was really interesting and really great the way you explained it, because I actually understood it, that our brain is actually, like every night, our brain is getting rid of stuff it doesn't need and building and strengthening things it does. So how does the brain do to what seem like very different and almost opposing activities?
It's fascinating, isn't it? So we've realized over the past 10 or 15 years that sleep after learning is essential to hit the save button on new memories so that you don't forget. So sleep in that way is really future-proofing the information within the brain. But we've recently learned that sleep is much more intelligent than we once gave it credit for. Sleep can actually identify things that perhaps you've already learned previously, and you don't need to create duplicate copies of. It's a little bit like sorting through a hard drive and weeding out the stuff that you don't need. And also sleep tries to prioritize information, so things that are perhaps especially salient and important to you, sleep will preferentially enhance those things. And those things that perhaps don't seem to be as emotionally necessary for you, sleep may even let go of. So sleep is clever in that way. It seems to have an elegant algorithm for informational storage. And it has to have that, by the way, because the brain doesn't have infinite storage capacity. It's a fixed storage system. So something has to stay, something has to go, and sleep seems to have a really quite clever equation for dictating what you remember and what you forget.
And so what happens if we don't give our brains a chance to do all that by getting good and consistent night's sleep? What happens to those important functions?
Well, certainly there are incredible deleterious health and disease consequences downstairs in the body, but upstairs in the brain, we know that if you're not getting enough sleep, firstly, your brain cannot commit new experiences to memory effectively. In other words, your brain can't learn efficiently. So it's almost as though the memory circuits of the brain become waterlogged and you can't absorb new information. We also know that there are certain parts of your brain, particularly the higher level rational regions of the brain, regions that we call the prefrontal cortex that sit just above your eyes. Those areas act like a very clever CEO of the brain. But when you're underslept, those regions seem to get taken offline, so you become much more impulsive, much more emotionally irrational. You become much more hot-headed. You're much more likely to snap in terms of your emotions. We also know that if you're not getting enough sleep, the brain is actually not detoxing itself of the metabolic byproducts that build up whilst we're awake during the day. Wakefulness essentially is a form of low-level brain damage, but one of the critical toxins that sleep washes away at night is a sticky protein called beta amyloid. And it is beta amyloid that seems to be one of the leading causes of Alzheimer's disease. And this is why we now have developed and found very strong, significant links between people who aren't getting enough sleep during their lifespan and marked increases in Alzheimer's risk later in life.
We're talking with Matthew Walker, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley, about his most recent book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And Matthew, let's look across the life cycle and how our sleep needs change. And let's start with before birth. What does sleep have to do with fetal development?
It seems to have to do everything with fetal development, because in fact, almost 90% of the time that you are in utero developing, you are actually in some form of sleep. And it seems to be a particular type of sleep. It's a stage of sleep that we call rapid eye movement sleep, something that often is associated with dreaming. And it's that stage of sleep during that early developmental time in life that is actually acting almost like an electrical fertilizer for the central nervous system, particularly for the brain. So REM sleep at that time of life, it's a little bit like an internet service provider that has a whole new neighborhood of houses. And its job is to go in there and lay down all of that fiber optic cable for high-speed broadband connectivity. And it seems to sort of flourish and populate all of the different neighborhoods of the brain with this connectivity, and then actually ignite it with that high-speed broadband electrical connection activity. So sleep in utero is absolutely essential, and there were studies done back in the 1970s where they actually deprived young infant rats of that REM sleep, and it significantly blunted the developmental trajectory of brain structure. So I think it's a real warning for us as we see sleep time start to decrease across the lifespan, but particularly in younger adults.
So does that continue once a child is born in the first year of life, the first few years of life? Is sleep that important for development then as well?
It is. It is absolutely essential. And not just in humans, by the way. In every species that we've studied to date, sleep is in highest amounts early in life. It seems to be a universal feature of sleep and life on this planet. And we think it's exactly for that purpose. It's for the explosion of growth and development, both of the body, but also in particular those animals that have complex nervous systems. That's where we see sleep in highest amounts in those early stages of life, post-utero.
Well, let's move on to the age group that gets a lot of attention and grief about their sleep habits, teenagers. What is that shift that I think any of us who have been teenagers or have lived with teenagers have seen, where they stay up late, they want to sleep as long as possible, and they have a really hard time getting up?
Yeah, what is going on there? Well, there's really a collision of two factors, one that's natural and one that's artificial. The natural part of that equation is that once you go through that adolescent transition, there is a shift that happens in your 24-hour clock timing within the brain, and it forces you further forward in time, so you start to want to go to bed later and wake up later. So it's not teenagers being rebellious. It's not their fault. If you say, you know, get to bed, it's 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and they're still awake, you know, at 11 o'clock. It's just their biology, and it's a genetic predeterminant. It's not their fault. However much they would wish or will themselves to be asleep, it's not going to happen. So that's the first aspect, and that's very natural. We know that that happens. The artificial force, however, that often makes us think that teenagers are perhaps a little bit lazy, especially during weekends where they seem to sleep in or sleep too much. You know, it's that idea of a parent going into the teenager's room, you pull the covers off and you open the curtains and you say, look, you're wasting the day, it's midday. Well, part of that is due to that fast-forwarding in time of the 24-hour clock. But a much bigger part of that is that they are sleeping off a remarkable debt, a sleep debt, that we have lumbered them with this incessant model of early school start times during the week. Mm-hmm. And that has to change because it has marked deleterious consequences, both on their academic development, their grades, as well as their psychiatric and mental states, as well as their life expectancy when it comes to driving accidents as well. So that's the second part of that adolescent equation.
And finally, what about the elderly? There's a common belief that the elderly don't need as much sleep. Is that actually true?
Well, it's one of the myths that I actually debunk in the book, and I spend an entire chapter on this, Sleep Across the Lifespan. It's not true. We know that older adults seem to need just as much sleep in the 60s, 70s, and 80s as they did in the 40s. It's simply that the older adult brain is not capable of generating the sleep that it still necessarily needs. So it's a deficit in the ability to get the sleep rather than a reduction in the need for sleep.
And we'll talk about some of the things that can interfere with getting a good night's sleep in just a moment. We're talking with sleep researcher Matthew Walker about his new book, Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel guilty about sleeping a full 8 hours or maybe for taking a nap? Has how and how much you sleep changed as you've aged? And are you one of the millions of Americans with sleep problems? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Matthew Walker. He's a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. His most recent book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. And we want to hear from you. How well do you sleep? Have you found any tricks to help you get a good night's sleep? Or maybe you need some. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Matthew, you lay out a really convincing case for why adequate sleep is important, but what if it eludes us? There are a lot of people that have sleep problems. What should people do and what should they not do?
Well, I think beyond making sure that you carve out enough time to sleep, and right now the World Health Organization recommends an 8-hour sleep opportunity every night, there are probably 5 things that people can do to start to get better sleep. The first is regularity. Try to go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time, no matter what. Sometimes people will make the mistake of sort of staying up late and then waking up late, particularly on the weekends. It's what we call social jet lag. And that sort of pulling forward and back of your body clock in time is really not great for your sleep. So keep it regular. The second is temperature. Keep your bedroom cool, probably cooler than you think. Around about 67, 68 degrees is optimal for most people. The reason is that your body needs to drop its core temperature to initiate sleep and stay asleep soundly. So you can help it do that by keeping the room cool. The next is darkness. We actually are a dark-deprived society in this modern age. And you need darkness at night to allow the release of a hormone that is called melatonin. And melatonin helps time the healthy onset of natural sleep. So perhaps in the last hour before bed, just shut off half the lights. You don't need all of the lights on. Stay away from LED screens. They are particularly damaging, and that's been demonstrated with research that that can block that release of melatonin in deleterious ways. The next thing is not to stay in bed awake for too long. So if you've been in bed, either falling asleep or if you've woken up and you're trying to get back to sleep, if you've been awake there for about 25 minutes, don't stay in bed is the advice, because your brain quickly learns the association between your bed being the place of being awake rather than being asleep.
And probably so being stressed about not being able to fall asleep.
Exactly, yeah. So you, and association is a powerful thing in that regard, just as you mentioned. So what you should really do is get up, go to a different room, and in dim light, maybe just read a book. Don't check emails. Don't try to eat. It creates a habit. And only return to bed when you're sleepy, and that way you will relearn the association between your bedroom being about the place of sleep. The final thing usually makes me deeply unpopular, which is that you should abstain from caffeine after about 2 p.m., and you should skip the nightcap. Now, when it comes to caffeine, everyone knows that caffeine is an alerting substance. It can keep you awake, keep you a little wired. What some people don't realize, however, is that even if you can have a cup of coffee at night and you can fall asleep and stay asleep, you won't get into the very deepest stages of sleep. It will be a lighter form of sleep that you get. So then you wake up the next day, you don't feel refreshed, and you find yourself reaching for two cups of coffee rather than one, and it becomes a dependency and addiction cycle. Alcohol, then, is perhaps the most misunderstood drug of all. Alcohol is a sedative, and sedation is not sleep. Mm. So what people mistake when they say, oh, I have a little drink, a little nightcap before bed, and it helps me fall asleep, all you're doing is actually knocking your brain out. You're not helping it get into natural sleep. And then there are two more problems with alcohol. Firstly, alcohol will fragment your sleep, so you will wake up many more times throughout the night. And then finally, alcohol is actually very effective at blocking one type of sleep called rapid eye movement sleep, dream sleep, that we spoke about before.
And I'm going to ask you to hold on there, Matthew, because we have several people who want to join the conversation. We're getting a little short on time. So let's go to the phones, and Kelly in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
It's not really a question. It's just my experience. You should say, I was fine falling asleep, never had a problem until I had a child. And I call it like momsomnia. Like any little thing you hear, like you're up, you're ready to go. It takes you like four sleeping pills a night to be able to just like get into bed.
All right. And Kelly, I want to give Matthew a chance to respond. Matthew, I know you write quite a bit about sleeping pills.
Yeah, I do. And this is not uncommon with young children. In fact, there's some studies where people have looked at how the brain, whilst it's asleep, responds to the name or the sound of that individual's child. And the brain seems to be on hyper alert even when you're asleep relative to other sounds. So it's a very real phenomenon. Sleeping pills are a concern. The book goes into detail. Those sleeping pills do not produce naturalistic sleep, and I'm not trying to shame anyone here, and if you have any questions, go and see your doctor, but those sleeping pills have also been related to a higher risk of death and cancer. People need not necessarily seek sleeping pills, because there is a behavioral non-drug alternative called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. And I encourage people to either look at the chapter in the book on that, or just go onto the internet and search that term, and they should be able to find help.
Thanks for that call, Kelly. Let's go next to Katie in Eau Claire. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. So I recently had a baby, and I tried this with my daughter, but we've done the Ferberizing, or the cry it out method, and I've recently been reading a lot. Some people saying that it's good, some people saying that's bad, and I'm wondering what your guest take is on it.
All right. So, Matthew, for helping infants who are awake and crying, helping them get back to sleep so they can get that important sleep, what do you recommend?
Yeah, so the Ferberizing method created by a professor by that name is that sort of let the child cry it out treatment, and gradually, almost like sort of letting the rope out on a sailboat, it gradually sort of go longer and longer with the duration of time before you go back in to try and comfort the child. That does seem to have some degree of benefits. There are some studies demonstrating that. But I would also say that you should just be attuned to your child. And if you really feel as though after going through that process systematically that it just doesn't seem to be working, then it's not a one-size-fits-all, and you can look to the alternatives. And I think experts are great in that regard. You can try it. It is a proven method, but it isn't for everyone. So just be a wonderful mother in that sense and be attuned to what your child needs.
All right. Thanks for that call, Katie. And Ruth in Eau Claire says she recommends sleeping masks. Made a world of difference for her, but you need to get the right one. And you were talking about how important darkness is, Matthew. Is there something we should look for in a sleeping mask?
Sleeping masks can be useful. Some people find them a little bit uncomfortable. An alternative is actually just buying blackout curtains. They can actually be just as effective. Some people who are especially sort of morning types, they tend to like the light coming through to the curtains, and so they prefer non-blackout curtains. But if you are someone who is particularly light sensitive, and many of us are, you can certainly try those blackout curtains. They can be very beneficial.
And as we start to wrap up, Matthew, is it possible to sleep too much, either in one night, or if you're sleeping at night and then napping during the day? Can we sleep too much? Is there such a thing as too much of a good thing?
Well, there is something called hypersomnia, but we principally see that in depression. But even if you look at that data, it seems to be people may be reporting staying in bed too long rather than sleeping too long. So at present, we don't actually have strong evidence for this thing called too much sleep. Is there such a thing? I think it's potentially possible. Some people describe a sleep hangover when they oversleep. That's usually because they are chronically sleep deprived, and they try to oversleep and sleep off that debt.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. Matthew Walker is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at UC Berkeley and the director of its Center for Human Sleep Science. His book is Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams. This is Central Time. Some Wisconsin Democrats are feeling encouraged by Democratic victories in states like Alabama, Virginia, and Oklahoma. Amid what seems to be a national pro-Democratic wave and low approval ratings for a Republican White House, Wisconsin's Democrats are eyeing the midterm elections, the legislature, and even the governor's seat. But there are still some skeptics. Wisconsin doesn't have much in common with the states that saw recent Democratic victories, and Governor Scott Walker has won consecutive terms and a recall election. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and is director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. He's here to share his take on Wisconsin's Democrats. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, do you think Wisconsin will see a Democratic wave?
Well, I think the question is how big of a wave rather than will we see movement in a Democratic direction. And that actually is based, first of all, just on history. If we go back over the last 100 years, the president's party has lost support in the Congress in all but three of the midterms over that more than 100-year period, actually. Now, that also tends to trickle down to state legislatures and statewide races, but it's strongest for the U.S. House and somewhat weaker for the legislatures. But if you think of Wisconsin, we saw big waves in a Democratic direction in 2006 and 8, which after the 2008 election created a Democratic majority in both houses. And then we saw both of those majorities wiped out in the 2010 wave, which went the other way. So I think the balance of history is that midterms favor the out party, and that's the Democrats this time. But then how big is that wave, and how far down the ballot does it reach? Those are the questions that are still depending on who the candidates are mm-hmm. and what happens between now and next November.
Well, and as you said, historically, it would indicate that Democrats should have some momentum in the midterm elections. How much does the popularity or unpopularity of the sitting president influence midterm results when we look back at those historic data?
Quite a bit. We have presidential approval data going back to about 1948. And the approval of the president is one of the stronger effects on the size of the midterm vote swing. So President Trump right now has an average approval rating of between 37 and 39%, depending on which average you look at. That is historically low for any president at this point in their term. But on the other hand, it's been relatively stable since about September. So we really don't know at this moment whether it will decline over the next year or rise over the next year. But at this point, it's quite a low approval rating should it not change at all going into next year's elections. But the other big factor is the economy. Economic growth or wage increases is the other primary driver that we see of midterm results. And at the moment, we're seeing pretty strong growth in the economy with low unemployment and rising real wages. And so those are things that would mitigate the size of a Democratic wave. So again, we need to wait and see how do those things play out over the coming year. And how much might the economy reduce the impact of low presidential approval? Or if the economy were to flatten out some, how much of that then becomes more of a burden for Republicans?
It seems to me that there's an additional variable here, too, Charles, that usually the party in power is relatively unified. But right now, there are the Trump supporters, and then there is the rest of the GOP, which is trying to figure out how to be with their party but not get dragged down by their party. And so how might that play out in how people might vote, whether they identify more with the Trump Republican Party or the more traditional, historical Republican Party?
Right, and I think that is something that we're still sorting out. In Alabama, in their special Senate election on December 12th, you saw this sharp divide between the sort of insurgent wing of the party that supported Roy Moore. Now, Donald Trump initially supported Moore's opponent and then supported Moore in the general election in December. But there were certainly divisions within the Republican Party there, and that played a role in that election. On the other hand, in the Virginia governor's race, which happened in November, they have an odd-numbered election year for governors. There we saw a gubernatorial candidate who seemed a bit torn between adopting Trump's positions on a lot of things versus holding off on some. The Democrat won that race fairly handily. And one of the big things we saw in Virginia and also in Alabama was that the Democratic areas of both states turned out at levels not much below their turnout in 2016. While the Republican areas of both states dropped off to about half of their previous turnout. So even while the percentage of the vote didn't change between those areas, blue areas stayed blue and red areas stayed red, there was a lot less turnout in Republican areas. Whether that comes from division within the party or doldrums, or maybe because some of Trump's vote was brought in for him only and not really a reflection of party support, in the general elections we've seen in Virginia and Alabama, and to a lesser degree in New Jersey, we have seen this difference in turnout that's pretty striking.
Well, and it does seem like the Alabama election, where Democrats seem particularly excited with the win by Democrat Doug Jones in a deeply red state like Alabama, and just today that result was certified, despite Moore refusing to concede defeat and trying to contest that. But that election seems like there are so many peculiarities about it, that it was a special election, which doesn't necessarily hold over to general elections. And also that Roy Moore was about as flawed a candidate as you could find.
I think that's exactly right. And that's one of the reasons we should be cautious of reading too much into special elections, whether that one in Alabama or the 85 other special elections that have been held this past year. Most of those are state legislative races. Every race, when we get down to it, will also depend on who the candidates are, whether they run strong campaigns or weak campaigns. The Roy Moore scandal certainly played a role there that we wouldn't expect to see replicated in other races. And so if we have the force of history and presidential approval and the economy, we also in the end will have what kinds of candidates are nominated, if there's even a candidate on the ballot for both parties, because that plays a big role, especially mm-hmm. here in Wisconsin, and whether they run good or bad campaigns.
Well, and as you said, it's important that whichever party does not hold a seat actually gets someone to run. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson said of Roy Moore that that Alabamans didn't want somebody who dated 14-year-old girls. But as another commentator said, if Doug Jones wasn't there to run against him, then there's a good chance that Moore would be in the Senate.
And I think that's a very good example of how important it is to have well-qualified candidates on the ballot in the first place. I think if we didn't know anything about how the Republican race was going to shape up, let alone the scandal, you would be forgiven for thinking maybe no Democrat wanted to run in that race. After all, Jeff Sessions won that seat last time unopposed. And so having Jones in the position to take advantage of Moore's weaknesses as well as take advantages of the strengths Democrats have this year in terms of energy and turnout and so on, really does illustrate the importance of having someone on the ballot. And you might think that Alabama was just totally hopeless, but there are a lot of seats where we see no party's nominee. In the bluest seats, it's Republicans that don't run mm-hmm. anybody. In the reddest seats, it's Democrats that don't run anyone. Those are awfully partisan seats, so it's hard to know when running someone is a waste of resources, as opposed to when running someone is giving you an opportunity for unexpected pickups.
Charles Franklin is with us now. He's a professor at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. We're looking at Democratic victories in special elections around the country and whether it could signal a Democratic wave here in Wisconsin. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think a Democratic victory in Alabama's special election means anything for Wisconsin? Do you think that our state will see a pro-Democratic wave? Do you plan on voting any differently in the midterm elections? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're continuing the conversation with Charles Franklin. He's professor at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. And we're looking at whether political winds might be shifting in favor of Democrats for the midterm and state legislature elections here in Wisconsin. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think Democratic victories in special elections are a good sign for Wisconsin Democrats? Are you considering backing any of the Democratic candidates vying for governor? Why or why not? Or do you think Wisconsin will continue to elect mostly Republicans? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Charles, let's go to the phone, and Jennifer in Woodruff is up. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
What would you like to say?
Well, I'm concerned with the redistricting that took place that already hit us in Supreme Court, and I'm not sure that we have any possibility of Democrats winning.
That's a good point, Jennifer. Charles, what impact do you think that the current electoral maps would have, or if there was a Supreme Court decision that, that called for them to be redrawn?
Sure. And both of those are interesting questions. If the court orders redistricting, which is certainly possible, what we don't have any good idea of is how widespread that redistricting would be and how it would be done. So I think I will leave that as a great uncertainty of whether the court will rule for new districts, and if so, who will draw them, under what conditions will they be drawn, and what effect they have. We really don't know. So that's the giant unknown out there. When you look at the current districts, it's clear that Republicans do very well in the contested districts. But we're in a region where 5 points is not enough. Democrats would need to pick up about 10 points to really make some movement. And that reflects the fact that Republicans in contested races are frequently winning between 60 and 65 or 68% of the vote. Those districts would have to shift quite a bit to move them into Democratic control. And there, the numbers almost work out if Democrats could sweep districts won by up to 60% of the Republican vote. That would shift 4 seats in the state Senate, which is just the number Democrats have to pick up in order to win. And it would pick up 14 of the 15 seats Democrats would need to control the state assembly. But to control the assembly, they'd have to pick up at least one more seat that Republicans won with over 60% of the vote. So that's a high hurdle for Democrats to overcome. But it also rests on how we started the conversation. Sometimes an election wave is so massive that it overwhelms substantial party advantages. On the other hand, right now, Democrats have picked up about 5% of the vote compared to 2016 in those 86 special elections. So that would be only about halfway where they would need to get to reasonably be in a position to take up a majority here. But it comes back to, do we see a massive wave the way we did in 2010, or do we see more like a ripple that helps Democrats but is more like a ripple on the pond instead of a massive wave?
It's hard for a party that has been more or less out of power to run on their own record because it's hard for them to advance their own agenda. Democrats have framed the GOP tax bill that recently passed as legislation that favored the rich and would lose them public support. Here's a clip from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Republicans will rue the day they pass this bill, and you can bet Democrats will make sure of that. We are going to continue to hammer away at why this bill is so unpopular.
So a CNN poll showed that 55% of people were against the bill when it was passed. How much, Charles, do you think could unpopular national legislation passed by Republicans go in the favor of Democrats when people go to the voting booth?
Well, it certainly plays a role. If we could again flip the tables, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare in 2010, was an important part of the Republican victories that year, as it gave Republicans an issue to hammer away on. The polling this year has shown both the attempt to repeal Obamacare and the new tax legislation are both unpopular, but that same polling seems to show that the health care repeal was actually the more unpopular and more energizing to voters, whereas the tax bill so far is unpopular but doesn't necessarily seem to be motivating voters. I think the bigger point is that the incumbent party has to play defense, and that's a natural fact of having both the presidency and both houses of Congress, and here in Wisconsin, the governorship and both houses of the legislature since 2010.
Well, and just briefly, here in Wisconsin, it could also be the Foxconn deal that could be used if it turns out to be not that popular.
Indeed, or used as a strength for Republicans if it turns out to be producing the gains and jobs that they're promising at this point. Just as with the national economy, how things are going with the state economy, Foxconn is a big invisible thing. Does that seem to be succeeding or seem to be failing? In our polling of the Milwaukee area, the five counties around Milwaukee, people were on balance a bit optimistic that it would help create jobs, but were also pessimistic in believing that it would never pay for itself for the state contribution. So,
and we're going to have to leave it there. Charles, thanks so much for joining us. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. He joined us to look at the chances of a Republican of a Wisconsin seeing a Democratic wave after a victory in Alabama and other special elections.